The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
There's a story from the time of the Buddha about a king and a queen, and the king asks his queen one day if there's anyone that she holds dearer than herself. One might think that perhaps he's fishing for a compliment or just to see if his queen is truly loyal to her king. But she replies, "No, I don't see anyone dearer to me than myself." "And how about you? How do you see things?" And he said, "I too don't see anyone dearer to me than myself." And they were both followers of the Buddha, so they decided to go and ask the Buddha about this question. And his response was in a poem. He said, "Searching all directions with one's awareness, one finds no one dearer than oneself. In the same way, others are fiercely dear to themselves. So one should not hurt others if one loves oneself." And this is the way it seems that the Buddha thought it should be, that we love ourselves dearly, and in loving ourselves we should consider that all beings love themselves and therefore take care of all beings. In the West, though, there seems to be a thread or a maybe more than a thread, perhaps a river of a different kind of attitude about oneself. There's the perhaps now well-known story of the Dalai Lama in one meeting. I think it was in Massachusetts at the Insight Meditation Society, where somebody raised their hand and asked what to do or how to relate to not liking yourself. I don't know exactly the word he used, but the Dalai Lama was very confused by this question, and he had to go back and forth with the translator for a while to even understand what this person was asking. And finally, he understood, and he just said, he actually was kind of shocked that this was a possibility, that someone could not like themselves. And he went around and asked several people, do you feel this way? And he found many, many people in the room had that experience. Now, it may not be something that we feel all the time, or it may be a kind of a very common state that we get into, but most of us in this culture, in the West, seem to have at least some experience of what it means to not like oneself, to have a self-directed negativity. And that's what I'd like to talk about this evening, how to work with this, how to massage it with mindfulness, to not run from this and ignore it or push it away, but to actually, in a way, embrace the experience to transform it. There's many types of self-negativity, and they range from the subtle to the really blatant. From self-judgment, self-criticism, perhaps on the more subtle end, to self-blame, self-hatred, self-anger, many forms of low self-esteem, and feelings of unworthiness. So that there's an interesting point to think about here, because I think often when we have feelings of self-blame or self-judgment, we think of them in terms of being almost an accurate assessment of the situation. You know, I did something wrong, therefore I should blame myself for it. Or I did something wrong, therefore I should be hard on myself. And there's kind of a fine line to walk here. There's a way in which we can acknowledge our faults and yet not hate ourselves for them. So we can notice this distinction through the presence of aversion. If there's a sense of not liking, not of really having a sense of almost hostility directed towards oneself, we can acknowledge our faults without feeling that hostility directed to ourselves. So I just want to say that right up front, that I'm not talking about just simply telling ourselves we're wonderful all the time, but I'm talking about not directing these arrows of anger and hatred and hostility towards ourselves. And I do believe that what the Buddha taught about when we do love ourselves, when we do really feel that we are most dear, it spills over to taking care of our fellow human beings as well. So through loving ourselves, we learn how to love others. So primarily what I'm going to talk about tonight is very practical ways to explore these various kinds of self-directed negativity. It's something that I'm relatively familiar with, at least as I began really exploring my mind with mindfulness, I realized how much of this I had in my experience, how much self-hatred, self-anger, and feelings of unworthiness I had in my experience. But when I first started hearing Dharma talks about self-judgment, I thought, oh, I don't do that. And it was rampant, actually. It was really quite pervasive in my experience. So it's something that I've explored a lot. And the things that I'm going to talk about tonight are ways to explore this with mindfulness, which means that it encompasses not only working with it on the cushion in our meditation, in our formal meditation practice, but also in our daily lives. A large part of what I really love to talk about and teach about is how to work with our difficulties, our suffering, in our day-to-day lives. And a lot of the way I'm going to talk tonight are ways that we can work with these difficulties, these self-directed negativity in our day-to-day activities. So the first thing to do is to really just become familiar with them. Get to know where these states come up for you. Get to know when self-judgment, self-blame, self-criticism arise. When does it migrate into anger or hatred, self-hatred? Just beginning to be familiar with the various types of self-directed negativity. Now, it seems like, why do we want to get familiar with them? Well, I think I said this last week, perhaps some of you were here last week when I talked about this, that when we bring mindfulness to something, whether it's something difficult or something beautiful, it creates the conditions to free us from suffering in either case. If we bring our mindfulness to self-negativity, if we bring our mindfulness to self-blame, self-hatred, it creates the conditions for that to diminish in our experience. It's kind of counterintuitive. Sometimes we think if we turn our attention to something or we focus on something, that means it will increase. But with mindfulness, essentially what it does is it opens up some space around the experience and allows us to have a little bit of distance from it so that we don't get caught into those patterns. The patterns of self-blame, self-judgment are very strong internal stories, their internal patterns, and we get hooked into them, and they feed themselves. Through mindfulness, we can detach ourselves from that cycle so that they have a chance to diminish, we have a chance to let them go. So just beginning to get familiar with them, with mindfulness. It can be a little frightening at first to really confront these states. And with one group of students that I'm working with, somebody else also began to realize how pervasive these kinds of states are. You know, just how frequently they come up, that she hadn't really known. Just as I had said, you know, I didn't think there was a lot of self-judgment in my experience, but when I started looking, I found a lot of it. If it's not seen, it feeds itself. When these states are not seen, they act almost as a filter through which we judge our whole experience. If we have self-anger or self-blame or self-criticism, it becomes the way almost in which we perceive our experience. And things confirm those beliefs, essentially. So if those beliefs are not seen, they have the opportunity to act in our minds as a kind of almost a magnifier, a kind of a magnet for drawing more self-negativity, more self-judgment. So becoming familiar with them gives us it's the first step to becoming able to be free from them. One of the things I found myself in getting familiar with these states was that I actually discovered there was also what seemed to be an opposing kind of mind state in there, that was this almost self-congratulation or self-building up or telling myself, I can do this, I'm a good person, I'm not a bad person, or I'm a good, you know, whatever. And I discovered on one retreat in particular, the good-bad conversation in my mind was around how good of a meditator I was. And there were times when I was completely convinced I was the worst meditator in the retreat, and I had no idea what I was doing. My mind was wandering all the time, and I heard this, you know, you're no good, you don't know how to do this, you're a bad meditator. And then other times I would hear, I would, you know, be able to stay with my breath for a little while, and I would hear this, you're a good yogi. You know how to do this. You're the best meditator here. And so I heard these like two wildly discrepant voices in my mind. And on that retreat, I actually discovered that one was a setup for the other. That the self-congratulation actually was a setup, and that when I didn't reach, you know, it's like I'm the best meditator here, when I didn't come up to that standard because the next hour my mind was wandering all over the place, I would fall into the, well, obviously I'm a horrible meditator. So they kind of fed each other, those two states. So as you're looking at your experience around the self-negativity, be aware if there's any kind of building yourself up as well. I found I needed to be as conscientious about noticing those self-congratulatory thoughts as I did about the self-blaming thoughts. Because, in fact, it seemed the more careful I was about just recognizing, okay, there's another kind of praising. I started calling them praise and blame thoughts. So when the praising thoughts got strong, I could be almost assured the blaming thoughts would follow. So becoming aware of how that dynamic works in your experience. And I found that recognizing the praising part really being clear that, yep, that's also just the mind trying to prop itself up. Recognizing that part was actually for me a crucial part of, it was a start for me of being able to let go of that negativity. For me, they were so tightly tied together. So getting familiar with these states, getting to know what they're like, what do they feel like? What do they feel like in the body? What kinds of stories do they tell? I think a lot of these self-directed negative mind states have a strong thought-based component. We're telling ourselves we're no good, we hate ourselves. So recognizing that the thoughts actually strengthen those mind states. So if you can let go of the thoughts and come into just what does it feel like in the body to have that that attitude of self-judgment or self-blame, I found it kind of has a feeling of, you know, heaviness or of a lowness, a feeling almost a subtle depression. So just connecting with the physical experience helps to cut that stream of thinking. And without the stream of thinking, there's less of a feeding of the state. So getting familiar with them, getting familiar with what your mind does around this kind of state. Another way that I found very supportive in working with self-negative states is to begin to really recognize when they're not there. So we tend to, I think, identify pretty strongly with some of these. If you have a tendency towards this kind of state, we tend to identify with them. You know, we feel like we're a bad person sometimes, or we feel like we just can't do anything right. And with that identification, again, it's kind of like that filter through which we see our experience. When we have that view, everything comes in that way and it reinforces that identity. And even when we're not experiencing that, we tend to dismiss it. We might tend to think, well, yeah, I'm not feeling that now, but I know I'm that kind of a person. I know that I'm really not a good person. So if you can really connect to and recognize when those states are absent, it begins to poke holes in that identity. It begins to poke holes in the feeling or the belief that it's always there. Sometimes with these things we strongly identify with, we just simply don't notice when they're not there, but we do notice when they are there. So they're not there all the time, but it's more of a weight is put on to those times when we're in those states. Yeah, there I am judging myself again. I do that all the time. We don't remind ourselves, oh, there I am not judging myself. I do that all the time too. So beginning to recognize when those states are absent is extremely supportive of, again, poking holes in any clinging or identification we have around these states. It sounds odd, perhaps, to talk about clinging to self-negativity, but we do that. We actually cling. We hold on to these states because, I don't know, in some way it's like we're familiar in some ways with being that way. It's like, yeah, this is me. I know this person. I know this person who beats herself up. I know this person who tells herself that she doesn't do things right. If you actually look in your own experience, you'll see that there is a way in which we gravitate to those states because they're so familiar. So beginning to really recognize when they're not there, very supportive. So becoming familiar with the states, recognizing when they're absent. Then in Another very helpful thing is that sometimes, you know, when we're being mindful of something like self-hatred or self-anger or self-criticism, we find that we, you know, that it's there. It's not like being mindful of it makes it go away. You know, that when we bring mindfulness to some of these very strong habits and patterns, they don't simply vanish immediately. So another helpful thing to look at is when you're paying attention or when something comes in, some of these self-negative patterns appear in your experience, and you are paying attention to them and you are mindful of them. See if you can notice the difference between when you're caught by that self-negativity and when you're observing it but you're not caught by it. The mindfulness does have this capacity to allow us to be just a little separated from our experience. Sometimes the mindfulness isn't quite strong enough, and all that we're able to really see is just being caught by it, really just seeing ourselves, flagellating ourselves or hating ourselves. I remember on one retreat, things kept happening where I just felt like I would descend into this hell for days at a time because of something that happened in an interview. And I would just feel like, oh, I'm just such a bad person. And I would just be caught. I could see it, but I really felt like I was a bad person, even though I was mindful. I could see it happening. And there can be times when we are mindful of it, and it feels like, oh, there it is. Yeah, I see those thoughts. I see that pattern. I even feel some of the bodily feelings. But it doesn't particularly feel like a problem. And that's pretty much the hallmark of being caught or not being caught. Does it feel like a problem, or does it feel like, oh, there it is. It's just something that's happening right now in the moment, this stream of thoughts about not liking myself. So seeing if you can recognize that feeling of being caught and then when it lets go. Sometimes I've been in states like this where I'll see it and I'll see myself get caught, and then in a few seconds I see, oh, it's not a problem. And then I see myself get caught again, and then it's not a problem. So sometimes it can come and go like that within the space of seconds or minutes. And it's very helpful to get familiar with the difference, to get familiar with what does it feel like when we're caught and what does it feel like when we're not caught. And what you'll see, I think, when you play with this is that when you're caught, it feels like there is suffering. It feels like, it really feels like that first noble truth. There is suffering. And when we're not caught, it doesn't have that quality of feeling like suffering. It feels like just something that's happening in the moment. So there's not a problem around it. And the instructions around suffering are to understand it. So when we're caught by it, it doesn't mean that we're failing in our mindfulness. That's, I think, something that we often misunderstand about mindfulness. That we think that if we're properly mindful, we won't be caught. But sometimes those patterns are so strong that all that the mindfulness can do is observe the pattern and observe the suffering and understand that it's the being caught by it, that it's something the mind is doing. It's something that our own minds are doing that are catching us to that state. And we can see as we move between them, we move between being caught, being not caught, we see it's almost like a magic shift, and we see it's our own minds letting go of something. And when we're caught, we see, yep, our minds are doing that again. We see the suffering of what our own minds are creating. And that is the beginning of the understanding. That's that first noble truth, beginning to understand suffering, understanding that that suffering is created through that holding on to with the mind. Something that our own minds are doing is creating that feeling of being caught, that feeling of suffering. So beginning to get familiar with the two. And again, not so that we feel like we're doing it wrong when we see that we're caught, but so that we can understand the suffering of the being caught. The more we understand the suffering of being caught, the more the mind begins to let go of the suffering. The more it lets go of what it's holding on to that's causing the suffering. There's another analogy I like to use with this being caught or not being caught. And in the, it's almost like with some of these states of self-negativity, of self-anger or self-judgment. It's almost like gears. And that when we're caught or engaged in it, it's like the gears are moving. And they're churning more self-negativity and more self-hatred. When we can observe with mindfulness either the caughtness or the not caughtness, it's like the gears are disengaged. So we're still seeing the spinning of the gears. We're still seeing all of that happen, but it's no longer generating more because the gears are not engaged anymore. That's another way I like to think about how mindfulness moves us in the direction of non-suffering. So recognizing when you're caught by the state of self-anger, self-blame, unworthiness, self-criticism, self-blame, and when you're not caught by it. Another thing to consider and look at is whether there are any beliefs operating around those states. Usually with this kind of state, there's some kind of belief going on. And the degree to which we're caught, the degree to which we believe, essentially the caughtness is about believing it. If we didn't believe we were a bad person, we wouldn't be caught by it. So, you know, in a sense, it's all about belief. It's all about view. It's all about, you know, a belief that we are essentially not worthy of self-love, or it's a belief that we don't do anything right. And there can be some, so there's the kind of just basic belief of the state itself. You know, if there's this self-anger, I'm no good, there's a kind of if we're caught by that, there's a belief that we're no good. Or I'm to blame. If we're caught by that, there's a belief that I'm to blame. But there's also possibly some other belief underneath that may be. And this can be very different. It can be very different depending on your how you've been raised, what your conditioning has been, essentially. So looking at your beliefs, looking at what's underneath that anger, that self-judgment. And you could do this by simply asking yourself when you're in this kind of a state, when you're feeling this self-judgment or self-anger, what do I believe here? What's the belief underneath this? You might just try asking that question, and not particularly to search for the answer, but to just open yourself up to the possibility that there might be something underneath, another belief that's kind of supporting that self-anger or self-hatred. So just kind of asking that question and sitting back and waiting almost, kind of like you ring a doorbell by asking the question and just seeing, does something come up? Not to search for it or think about it. I think if we start thinking about it, often what happens is that we're basically caught into the patterns themselves when we're thinking consciously about it. So simply see if you can, it's almost like just kind of taking a step back, opening up to, with that question and saying, is there anything there? Are there any beliefs there? If you don't see anything obvious, don't worry about it. Just, you know, keep paying attention with mindfulness. Just keep bringing your attention to the experience as much as you can. And just occasionally ask yourself that question. Is there a belief operating here? Some of these beliefs, I think, go really, really deep. I mean, in my own experience, you know, I think some of them came from childhood, a feeling of not being seen as a child sometimes and not being worthy to be seen. So allowing some of those beliefs to come into consciousness, again, when they come into consciousness, we have the chance to not be unconsciously or subconsciously driven by them. One belief I noticed around self-judgment, particularly, and I mentioned this a little bit at the beginning, particularly if I'd done something wrong or if I felt like, you know, I had done something unskillful or hurt somebody, there was this kind of a, you know, self-judgment and self-blaming. Oh, I did that badly, and I'm no good. And there was a way in which there was a belief that I needed to blame myself in order that I wouldn't do it again. Essentially, I needed to hate myself so that, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, the punishment. You know, I needed to punish myself in order that I wouldn't do it again, because if I did it again, then I'd have to punish myself again. And obviously I didn't want to punish myself, you know, so it's kind of this cycle. But I discovered that you don't have to blame yourself or judge yourself in order to skillfully reflect and recognize, yeah, that was unskillful, and perhaps to make some amends, to move out to talk to the person that they've harmed and say, I apologize, I'm sorry. I will do my best to try not to do this again. And it's not necessary to do the self-flagellation. But there was a belief that it was necessary. Somewhere underneath, there was a belief that it was necessary. And I was surprised when I saw that. It's like, wow. It feels like, you know, it's almost as if, you know, I was aware of what I was doing, and it's almost like the awareness had been co-opted by this belief that I needed to do this to myself. I needed to beat myself up about this. So that's the kind of belief I'm talking about that you might find or explore. And, you know, leave yourselves open to what it might be. These things can be surprising when we discover them. Sometimes, well, let me just recap here. It's sometimes helpful to review. So there's just becoming familiar with the states, just getting to know them with mindfulness, getting to know the opposite of it, you know, whether you have any of that tendency to prop yourself up and beat yourself up, both sides. So getting familiar with them, recognizing when the states are absent, when they're not there. When you are aware of them, noticing when you're caught by the state and when you're not caught by it. So can you notice a difference in when you are paying attention to it, what it feels like to have the state happening but not be caught by it, and what does it feel like when you are caught by it? And then looking for beliefs. Are there any beliefs operating in these mind states? Sometimes these states, I mean, sometimes they're pretty mild. I mean, it's just a kind of a little bit of, I didn't do that very well. And it's just a little kind of, just a little aversion in there. And other times they can be very strong. They can be just to the point of just all out, full on self-hatred. Very, very powerful states. And sometimes our mindfulness is not really strong enough to meet some of these more powerful states of self-negativity. So if you're trying to observe these states, if you're looking at self-hatred, for example, and all you find is that, you know, you say, oh, I've got to pay attention to this, and you start trying to pay attention in your body, and then seconds later you find you're back into that real pattern of self-negativity, and you've lost your mindfulness, so you've gotten sucked into it again. If you find that that happens repeatedly and that you're not really able to observe it with mindfulness, I'm not talking about the being caught and knowing it. I'm talking about just getting sucked into it again. If you find that happens, you need to respect the power of those states of mind. And it's often more helpful to allow yourself a break from trying to pay attention to something that is overwhelming you. There's a couple of ways to approach this. One way is a kind of a gentle way, and it's more about just broadening your awareness of what's going on in your experience. Sometimes when we're caught by these states, like self-hatred, it's like it becomes all-encompassing. It's all that we see. It's everything that we see is around that self-hatred. So it's sometimes possible to open up our awareness a little bit and remind ourselves that there are other things going on in our experience. There's sights coming in. If we're taking a walk, for instance, and we're finding ourselves just beating ourselves up and immersed in this self-negativity, we can remind ourselves, I'm taking a walk. I'm seeing the trees. I'm feeling the breeze. I'm hearing the sounds of the cars and the birds. I'm seeing the dogs and the flowers. I'm seeing all of these things. So there's a lot going on in my experience other than this self-hatred. So opening up your awareness, consciously trying to expand your awareness to include more, taking a really broad view of your experience. I found this to be really helpful. And to not, again, it's to not push away the that self-negativity, but to more recognize that it's one thing among thousands that are happening right in this moment. So you're taking a walk, and there's the seeing and the hearing and the breeze on your cheeks. And, yeah, there's the self-negativity, and there's the seeing and the hearing and the... So there's a lot going on, and we don't push away the fact that the self-negativity is happening, but we give it a much bigger space so that there's a kind of an acknowledgement that there's a lot more happening. Sometimes that's not quite enough. Sometimes if we're really caught, we have to be a little more forceful about turning our attention away from it. And again, it's not to push it away with aversion. If we're pushing away self-negativity with aversion, we're reinforcing a negative pattern. So we need to be a little more gentle about redirecting our attention, not with that attitude. And it's mostly got to do with how we redirect our attention. It's not so much about the redirecting itself. It's more about, are we redirecting our attention with, I can't be with that, forget it, you know, I'm going to ignore that and be with something else? Or is it more of a sense of, okay, I'm just going to turn my attention elsewhere because it's not so helpful to pay attention to that self-negativity right now. So turning our attention to something with a gentler attitude, essentially. It's more of a not now kind of approach as opposed to never again. So it's a gentler turning your attention away. But it is a very conscious directing your attention elsewhere. And I found it helpful in particular to direct my attention to something kind of neutral in my experience. Something perhaps, you know, the sensation of your butt on the chair or feet on the floor or perhaps hearing. Something that isn't so highly charged in your experience. If you try to come in to the body and pay attention to the breathing, that might work, but also it's possible with feelings of strong emotional experience in general, not just self-negativity, but strong emotional experience in general, tends to have a lot of experience, emotion, feeling happening in this area. And so if you turn your attention to pay attention to the breath in this area, you're probably also going to run into some of those experiences of the difficult emotion too, and you can end up getting caught by them again. So I found it helpful to cultivate something outside of the kind of torso area where I can balance my attention with something a little more neutral. It can also be helpful in that kind of a state when it's difficult. You might try redirecting your attention to kindness towards yourself, practicing a little bit of metta or practicing a little bit of kindness or compassion if the kindness is a little difficult. Sometimes when we're in negative states, mustering a sense of kindness can be difficult, but mustering a sense of compassion for the fact that we're in this state can be a little bit easier. So bringing a little bit of a sense of compassion into your experience. These states can be very challenging to work with, so being very kind to yourself, perhaps allowing yourself to work with them for a time and then back off and perhaps practice some metta or practice some compassion. The metta practice, the compassion practice, can be antidotes for that negativity, the aversion that's inherent in self-negativity. The antidote for it is this kindness, is this sending kindness. So if you can connect to that, it's a very helpful antidote to those states. Now, I myself, early in my practice, or not even so early, I mean, for the first many years of my practice, I found connecting to the metta practice to be extremely difficult. And I think there was a very strong connection with this self-hatred and not being able to send metta to myself. So I had to let go of that particular practice for quite a long time. I did play with it in various ways, and there are some ways that we can play with metta if we do have trouble sending metta to ourselves. One way that I found helpful was to imagine myself surrounded by people I knew loved me, my mother, for example, and imagined her wishing me well. I could accept kindness coming from my mother and from my friends more easily than I could accept it coming from myself. So I found that to be a helpful way to approach metta. But there were times when I couldn't even approach it that way. And, you know, it really was easier for me to just turn my attention to something neutral in my experience rather than to try to muster up any kind of kindness to myself. So if you find metta difficult, that's okay. Don't force yourself to do that practice, feeling like Again, taking the case of beating yourself up because you can't do something. Just simply relax around it and use whatever means are skillful for you to work with these states. The last thing that I'll mention as a way or a technique, a practice for working with this, comes right from the Buddha. And his instruction, I mean, I think this really speaks to the identification that we have with these self-negativity. And his instruction is, nothing is worth clinging to as I, me, or mine. So you could try using this almost as a reflection. If you're having these states of self-anger, self-judgment, can you bring into your mind stream this reflection? Nothing is worth clinging to as I or mine. Nothing is worth clinging to as I or mine. And just see how it impacts your experience. It may not have a very strong impact initially, but it does kind of open the mind to non-clinging. It opens the mind to not holding on to things that we hold on to so tightly. And over time, it can have an opening effect, a freeing effect on our experience, to simply make this, even as a conscious reflection, nothing is worth clinging to as I or mine. So again, these states are very challenging to work with. They can be challenging to work with. And it takes a lot of courage. It takes a lot of courage to face some of these states. I like the fact that the quality of energy, often the word virya is translated as energy into English. This quality, one of the main qualities that we bring to our practice, is quality of energy. But it is also has a component of it as meaning courage. So this term for energy also brings with it a sense of courage to meet our experience. So it does take courage to meet some of these very negative, self-negative states. Sometimes we think when we bring our attention to them, it's almost like we'll be obliterated into those self-negative states. And in a funny way, it's actually strengthening a view of self to have these negative views of self. It's strengthening a negative view of self, but it's strengthening a view of self. It's strengthening a very unskillful view of self. And it takes courage to face that because it's so unpleasant. It's so threatening to us to face those states. Facing states of self-hatred were some of the more challenging things that I worked with in my practice. They've been just some deep, deep states of self-hatred, and just allowing myself to be with them. Getting to the point where I could be with them took a lot of courage and a lot of patience. But there is movement on the other side of that difficulty. We can free ourselves from these difficult states. It's possible to have them become much less of a force driving our day-to-day experience through just bringing our mindfulness to explore. So that's enough, I think, for me. Are there Any comments or questions? Anything you'd like to share? Yeah.
So I think you just summarized my whole week, or maybe my whole life. It's really interesting because I had some thoughts where, you know, an unskillful action at work with family members. And then all of a sudden I broke out into this rash on my upper body and my arms. And it was really interesting. Of course, the medical reason was, oh, you had an insect bite a month ago and then it was a reactivation. But I thought of that metaphor. And there were 20 million arrows. I mean, arrows after arrow. It must have been because I did this. It must have been because I did that. And I could not get out of it. I tried a couple of things you'd mentioned. And so then something happened last night where, you know, I felt like there were so many spots on fire. And then I woke up and I couldn't sleep. And I'm like, you're so lame. You can't sleep. And that process just kept going on. And then finally, I don't know what it was that drove it, but finally I just said, you know, this is all okay. It doesn't matter how I feel. It doesn't matter what's been done. It doesn't matter what it looks like. You know, your mind's hilarious that it just does this thing to itself. And when I finally came to terms with that, it's all okay. It's just fine. I mean, that was the moment of waking up, and you're so right. That difference between heaviness and feeling like you're dragging your life, blaming yourself, versus I feel like 20 pounds lighter,
yes,
or maybe much more than that, when I just realize that it's okay.
Yeah, it's a huge shift. I mean, it's something that our mind does as we try to bring our mind to it. It sounds like you were working with the mindfulness all week, and it bore the fruit last night. I mean, it's that recognition, oh, this is just the mind doing its thing, and we're now not caught anymore. And it's huge. It's a huge difference. So I'm very happy that you saw that. Thank you for sharing that. Anyone else? Yeah.
I was also reading a book that I got at the library here, and just this morning, as a matter of fact, when he talked about labeling unwholesome thoughts, and that's the way to let the thought go and let it diminish anyway. But I'm not sure I understand that very well. How come labeling a thought, how does that thought diminish?
So yeah, that's a good question. Essentially what's happening when you use labeling, so for instance, you might have the thought, you're no good. And you could come up with a label for that, like blame, you know, some blaming thought or something like that. And when you are using a part of your mind to recognize another part of your mind, you're no longer quite so caught into the blaming itself, because there's another part of your mind functioning that's observing it. And there's actually been some studies done on this recently. It's very interesting that the psychologists have started to look at this technique of labeling. And they found that when people label their emotions, like anger, it actually changes the brain. It changes the way the brain is functioning to do that labeling. Again, because it's engaging a higher cortex. It's engaging a different part of the mind. And the emotions tend to be deeper into the reptilian brain. And the higher part of the higher cortex gets engaged, and it takes some of that emphasis on the emotion or on the thoughts, essentially, away. And I think the same thing happens for patterns of thought. Often those patterns of thought are bound up with emotions, difficult emotions. And so, again, bringing that labeling engages a different part of the mind, a different part of the brain that essentially tends to balance things out for us.
Is it kind of like you are seeing things from a different level?
Yes, that's a good way to look at it. Uh-huh. Yeah, you're seeing things from a different level.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So it's 9:00. So may you all find yourselves most dear. And may all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be safe. May all beings live with ease. May all beings be free from suffering. Thank you.